CNN's Jake Tapper joins us this morning for a conversation about America's long struggle with terrorism, from the battlefields of Afghanistan to the aftermath of the Arab Spring and the challenges we continue to face at home. His new book, Race Against Terror, Chasing an Al-Qaeda Terrorist at the Dawn of the Forever War. It uncovers one of the most remarkable but little-known cases in recent history. It begins in 2011 when a man fleeing unrest in North Africa was stopped by Italian authorities. Almost casually, he admitted to being an Al-Qaeda operative responsible for the deaths of U.S. soldiers. That stunning revelation set in motion an international investigation connecting refugee boats, courtrooms, intelligence agencies, and the Oval Office itself. We talked with Jake Tapper this morning about how America's war on terror has changed the country and the world, why it continues to matter today in the conflict between Israel and Hamas, how the assassination of Charlie Kirk offers a stark warning against extremism on the American home front, and the heroism required to protect our freedoms. Again, the new book is Race Against Terror. It is always a pleasure to welcome Jake Tapper to our program. How are you?
I'm well, or as well as anybody can be in these turbulent times, but good, pretty good.
Very good. When did you start to think that you wanted to write this particular story and invest the time that it would take to really look into it?
So the last nonfiction book I wrote was The Outpost, which came out in 2012, about a true story about a doomed combat outpost in Afghanistan. And that was a very special project for me. I became very emotionally invested in telling the stories of the service members who served at Combat Outpost Keating. And I knew I couldn't just rush into another nonfiction book. And indeed, this one took another decade before the story found me. You know, I was looking into other stories, but when you write a nonfiction book, it's years and years of work, and you want to make sure that you really care about it. You really want to invest the time and the energy into telling the story. So it wasn't until 2022 that I heard the story about this terrorist, Spin Ghoul, and the fact that this was the very first and as of now, only time that a U.S. Criminal court heard the case of a foreign terrorist who was being tried for killing U.S. service members on a battlefield abroad. It's never happened before. And the story was just so fascinating when I heard it that I thought to myself, oh, this might be something that would be a good project for me over the next several years. So that was 2022.
I assume in that time, though, even then, you think to yourself that this is a story, while it happened more than a decade ago, that it is still relevant.
Well, it's still the only case of its kind of the U.S. trying a foreign terrorist in a criminal court for killing soldiers abroad on a battlefield. But also beyond that, the terrorist threat has not lessened. We in the public and in the news media are more used to covering terrorist attacks, but they happen all the time. You could argue that the attack on Charlie Kirk, the assassination of Charlie Kirk, was a terrorist attack, since it does seem to have been politically motivated. But beyond that, this year, 2025, it started with a terrorist attack in New Orleans, somebody that appears to have been influenced by ISIS, the terrorist group ISIS. So it does not stop. And FBI agents and prosecutors and law enforcement have to bat 1,000 when it comes to this challenge. And political violence is just another form of terrorism in this country. And that seems to be getting worse. So the threat is even more unrelenting than it ever has been.
Give us the setup here of how ultimately, from the telling of the story of what your questions were, meaning the first time you heard the story, you hear the story in 2022, and then how you start to backtrack and get to the facts of what happened.
It was almost exactly 3 years ago. It was October 2022. And I remember it because it was my son's birthday, and it was a paintball party that we had in rural Virginia. And because it's an hour outside of D.C., I just always, I provide food and refreshments for the adults so that they can just sit there and hang out, and we can all talk for a couple hours while their sons are off paintballing each other in the woods, and they don't have to make the drive four times. They only have to make it twice. So one of the dads, who I had never met before, starts talking to me about the outpost and says that he knows a guy named Dave Roller, who is one of the heroes of the book The Outpost, Lieutenant Dave Roller. And I start talking about how difficult it was to write that book for any number of reasons, one of which is the military keeps such awful records, and they're also not eager to share them. Even if you are, commemorating and recording for history the bravery of service members, it's tough to get information from the Pentagon. And this guy, Dave Bittkauer, says, "Tell me about it." And then he proceeds to tell me a story about when he was an assistant U.S. prosecutor in Brooklyn, and he gets a phone call from the FBI saying that the Italians had just picked up some guy on a cruise ship during the Arab Spring. This is 2011. Who claims that he's Al Qaeda and that he's killed service members in Afghanistan? And then Dave Bittkauer and others fly to Italy, hear the confession of this guy who is proud of his works as a terrorist, a guy named Spin Ghoul. That's what his battlefield name is. And Spin Ghoul is confessing to these crimes, and the US prosecutors, Bittkauer and Shreve Ariel and others, think to themselves, wow, this guy sounds like the real deal, and we've heard of him before from other terrorists, and we need to keep him off the streets. But the Italians are like, you take him. We don't want him. He hasn't done anything to us, but take him. But the Americans have to build a case because this is 2011. It's the Obama era. Gitmo is not taking any new people. If they want to bring him in, they have to try him in a criminal court. They have to win in a criminal court. And they can't just bring this guy in and say, hey, he confesses, because any defense attorney would say, he's crazy. You have no proof that he did any of this. And then all of a sudden, you'd have this serial killer, potential serial killer on the streets of Brooklyn, free. So it's a very high stakes situation. And basically, what you have is the opposite of a whodunit. Here's the bad guy. Now prove what he did. And they have to figure out what battle it was. They have to get evidence. They have to get witness testimony. They have to prove this story of this guy who, disappears in the night, a clandestine Al-Qaeda operative. And that story that he told me, which is in the book, I don't want to spoil it for the listeners, but how they found fingerprint evidence and how they found witness testimony and how they got other terrorist testimony, et cetera, was this unbelievably fascinating story. I get Dave's number and I take him and Shreve, his, assistant U.S. attorney, friend, partner, out to lunch. They tell me the whole story, and they're just unbelievable characters and hurdles in the investigation and this and that. This is all going on during the Obama era, by the way, where there's this, I mean, it's hugely politically sensitive, even the idea of taking a terrorist from abroad and bringing him to the US for prosecution was incredibly controversial. It's not as controversial today. President Trump announced during his joint address to Congress, Pakistani intelligence working with the CIA caught one of the guys responsible for the Abbey Gate suicide attack in Afghanistan in 2021. And he has been flown and he is in Virginia right now awaiting trial. So it's no longer as controversial, but it was very controversial at the time. And the stakes were so high because they knew if they failed, this guy was going to go kill as many Americans as possible. It was his life's ambition. He'd already killed two service members, wanted to blow up the U.S. Embassy in Nigeria, and was eager to get out and murder.
One of the things that I find so fascinating about this story and that you write about is that they have Ghoul's confession. The Italian government, they're ready to hand him over to the United States. They're ready. And obviously, as you mentioned, the US has to come up with a case to take him into custody. The thing I found so fascinating is how fast they needed to do it. The time was ticking on this.
Oh, the clock is hugely ticking because the Italians. So Spin Ghoul on that cruise ship, which had been commandeered by Berlusconi, people might remember in 2011 during the Arab Spring, there's this huge refugee crisis. All these people are fleeing Libya, fleeing Tunisia. And in that part of the world, in that part of the Mediterranean, the southern Italian islands are closer to Africa than they are to Rome. So they are getting in these little rickety boats and getting to the southern Italian islands. And so there's this refugee crisis. So Berlusconi starts commandeering cruise ships and taking the refugees from these islands, which are, tourist havens, and that have become refugee camps overnight. And he starts bringing them to the mainland, to refugee camps. Now, refugee camps are not high security camps. So Spin Gould's option was he was going, he hadn't done anything to the Italians other than when he was taken into custody on the Italian cruise ship by the law enforcement officials. What happens was he asks one of the Italian Green Berets for some water. The guy gives him some water, notices he has a scar on his arm, recognizes it as a bullet wound, asks him where he got it. And the guy basically confesses to having been in Al Qaeda and he got it fighting Americans in Afghanistan. They take him into a room and they start asking him questions. And he starts talking, telling his story. And then eventually he starts getting violent and unruly and they have to sedate him. The Italians can hold him for a couple months. That's it. He hasn't done anything to the Italians. And the Italians at this point in the US global war on terror are pretty fed up with the Americans. They're upset about torture. They're upset about Gitmo. They're upset about extraordinary rendition. An Egyptian who had found refuge in Italy was basically kidnapped by the Italians and Americans working in tandem in like right after 9/11 and taken and tortured. And at this point in US-Italy relations, things are fraught. A bunch of CIA officers have been convicted in absentia for kidnapping in Italy. So the Italians are not into what the Americans have been doing. And they don't care if it's under Obama or under Bush. It's all America to them. So they're like, look, we can hold him for a couple months, but if you want him, you got to take him. Otherwise, he'll go into a refugee camp. And these refugee camps, anybody can basically just like walk out of them. They're not high security situations, and certainly an Al Qaeda operative could figure a way out. So it's basically prove the case or he's going to roam free. So those are the stakes. I mean, if you know that there is a murderous, potential serial killing Al Qaeda operative, I mean, you know that you have a job to do. But on the other hand, if they take this case on and they fail, then that Al Qaeda operative could theoretically be walking around the United States. So it's a dilemma. But they don't really have a choice. They have to try to put him away.
And obviously the concern is that they bring him over to the US. A jury decides that he's crazy, and then because there's no evidence, they let him go. So then finding the evidence. So what goes into that?
Oh my God, so much. First of all, they don't even know what battle he confessed to killing Americans. They don't even know what battle it was. And, he sounds, when they go to Italy to hear his testimony, his confession, he sounds like he knows what he's talking about because he's mentioning the names of people that the Americans know were Al Qaeda operatives at the Afghanistan-Pakistan border in this time period, 2002 to 2003. But they don't know what ambush he's talking about, they don't know who he killed. And they have to put it together. And there are all sorts of hurdles, as I mentioned. Here's one that was particularly interesting. So at one point, he's telling the story. Spin Gould speaks basically Arabic and Hausa, which is a language of Africa. And so they have a translator in this Italian court. All of the testimony is very slow because it has to be translated from Hausa to Italian for the judge. And then it has to be translated from Hausa or Arabic to English for the Americans. So everything he says takes a long time. At one point, the translator, when Shreve, the assistant U.S. attorney, is trying to figure out when the battle took place, at one point the translator says something about that Spin Gould testified that this was right before Ramses V came to visit Afghanistan. And our prosecutors' hearts sink. They're like, oh God, he thinks that the pharaohs are still alive. He's crazy. We're never going to be able to get a conviction, even though on everything else, he sounds completely fact-based. But now he's talking about Ramses the Fifth. This is horrible. But later on in the testimony, Shreve lets that slide for a second, and then later on in the testimony, when Ramses the Fifth comes up again, Shreve pokes and prods a little bit. What are you talking about? Who are you talking about? And the translator goes back to Spin Ghul, and they have a conversation, and then he realizes, no, he's not saying Ramses the Fifth visiting Afghanistan. He's saying Rumsfeld, Rumsfeld. And he's saying the fifth, he's holding up five fingers to signify the five sides of the Pentagon. And the prosecutors breathe a sigh of relief. So they're like, okay, so this is around the time that Rumsfeld was supposed to visit Afghanistan. And they're able to take that information and through process of elimination, figure out that the battle, the ambush he's talking about, was probably this one on April 25th, 2003. So then they have to go and track down all the service members, all the soldiers who were there, and try to see if there's any evidence that they saw or that they had, if they saw Spin Ghul, anything at all. And again, this is all a very, very labor-intensive process, but the stakes couldn't be higher.
And it's just one moment like that after another of a series of these breakthroughs that allow them to keep going.
Little by little by little, they build this incredible case where by the end of it, there is really no question that Spin Ghul did it. But the defense attorneys, and remember, and this is one of the arguments that people have against trying foreign terrorists in criminal courts, is that the defense attorneys get to have their shot at the argument too. And Spin Ghul gets three very smart, very talented defense attorneys who are completely dedicated to the principle of, everybody is entitled to the best attorney they can get. And these are great attorneys, and they're trying to do everything they can in terms of invoking the laws of war, invoking questions about Spin Ghul's sanity, because after he gets brought to the United States, he stops cooperating completely and starts behaving in very odd and aberrant ways. And there's until the verdict is read, it's never clear. They're never confident that this is going to go the way that they want it to go, the prosecutors.
In reading the story, when you look at it, and as you say, from the time the verdict is read to now, say, how do you think our thoughts on the war on terror and America's war on terror have changed over that period of time, and for want of a better term, evolved?
Well, I mean, they've been changing quite a bit. We're kind of in a consensus middle ground right now. But what President Bush and his team faced after 9/11 was a threat that the US had never experienced before. And there were a lot of changes to how terrorism cases were handled. First of all, there was Guantanamo Bay. Where detainees were taken and held as enemy combatants, where they basically had no rights initially. There was extraordinary rendition, which is basically kidnapping by, law enforcement of individuals from other countries. There was enhanced interrogation, which, for want of a better term, could be thought of as torture. There were any number of what I think civil libertarians would refer to as overreach by the Bush administration. Now, in defense of the Bush administration, they were doing what they thought they needed to do to keep America safe. But that push and pull was very strong. By the time we get to the Obama era in 2009, President Obama has made it clear that he wants to do things differently. He wants to try detainees in criminal courts. But it's not that simple. First of all, there are 200 something detainees at Guantanamo Bay, which, to this moment, remains open and operative with detainees in it. I think it's just a few dozen at this point. But the first thing Obama wants to do is try as many of them as possible, release others. He forms basically a commission to look at those who are being held there. Dave Bitcower and Shreve Arial, the assistant U.S. attorneys who try this case in my book, are on that commission, and they're looking at individual cases. Basically, Obama, his commission comes up with three groups. One, individuals who can be tried in U.S. criminal courts or military tribunals. Two, those who can be either freed or released to other countries. And three, this group that cannot be released and cannot be tried. And they cannot be released and they cannot be tried because the Obama administration decides they're too dangerous to release, but the evidence against them is too tainted because of the torture or enhanced interrogation methods used against them that would never stand up in a criminal court or even necessarily a military commission. So that's where we are today, even. And even though President Trump talks a lot about handling things differently than Obama, the truth is, this criminal defendant Jafar, who was one of the allegedly one of the conspirators behind the Abbey Gate bombing, he didn't go to Guantanamo Bay. He went to a criminal. He went to the Eastern District of Virginia, where he is awaiting trial. So we are basically in the same place in this hazy middle ground where enhanced interrogation doesn't happen anymore, as far as we know. Extraordinary rendition doesn't happen anymore, as far as we know. The military commissions are happening, but they're very, very slow, painstaking process, and very few people have been tried or plead guilty or not guilty in those. And basically, we're in a place that's neither Trump nor Obama, neither Bush nor Biden, where it's kind of just this hazy gray area where we are trying to stop the criminal terrorist attacks before they happen, killing terrorists abroad, however we do that, whether it's through drones or other ways to do that, and trying them in criminal courts in the US when appropriate. And so it's kind of evolved into a place where there isn't much debate anymore about it.
It's and really hard to figure out what's going to happen. I mean, this is fresh from the president speaking to the United Nations General Assembly, and you're just left shaking your head, going, "Well, what the hell are you going to make out of that?"
Well, this president has his way of doing things, but I find it, generally speaking, as a journalist, there's three things to pay attention to when it comes to President Trump. There is what he posts on social media, there is what he says publicly, wherever, and there is what his administration does. And I find it most important to focus on what he does because that is where the actual rubber meets the road. When he can say all sorts of outrageous or outlandish, provocative, norm-busting things, whatever adjective you want to use. But at the end of the day, what matters the most is how these thoughts and policies come to fruition, or if they even come to fruition. So, for instance, I think there's a big difference between him railing against media on social media and his government taking action to encourage private companies that need the government's approval on various business operations to drop Jimmy Kimmel. I mean, there just is a difference between ranting and raving and taking action that theoretically violates the First Amendment.
I mean, that's why you see the head of the FCC with sort of a hands off. Well, we didn't do anything. It was up to the stations. They were the ones that made the decision.
Yeah, although that's not true, obviously. They
Obviously.
did do something. The FCC went the FCC chairman went very publicly and called for these stations, Nexstar stations and Sinclair stations and others that carry Jimmy Kimmel live to stop airing it, and they did. I mean, he didn't call on Nexstar and Sinclair by name to do so, but those are two company he called on local stations to do so, and they did, and those are two sizable ones. And Nexstar right now is trying to acquire its second largest competitor and needs Brendan Carr's approval for that to happen because it would violate a rule at the FCC about having too broad a reach. So one of the ways that Trump is pushing the envelope or the lines when it comes to the prosecution of terrorists, though I should note, is that he has classified a drug trafficking cartel, Tren de Aragua, out of Venezuela as narco terrorists. And now the authorities that Obama used when he used drone strikes to attack terrorists, although he didn't only kill terrorists, he killed innocent people too when he did those attacks his under his command, that it is now being used not only towards terrorist groups or those around the terrorist groups or those unfortunate civilians who are mistakenly identified as terrorists. President Trump is saying, well, narco-terrorists, drug dealers kill hundreds of thousands of Americans. Therefore, I'm going to apply these same rules that Obama used to strike them. So that is, I mean, this is always the issue when it comes to presidents asserting power, that whatever you think of the president, the next president who you might not like will take that to power and expand it. And this just happens over and over and over, whether it's executive orders. President Trump was very critical of President Biden using executive orders, and now he's issued more executive orders than anyone in such a short time, and on and on. And he's doing the same with terrorism prosecutions. And even if your heart doesn't weep for drug dealers, the question of rights and judicial process and the military making mistakes and accidentally killing people who aren't the target. Are real issues to discuss.
Okay, Jake Tapper, lightning round. I've got 2.5 minutes and I have a
Okay.
couple questions. One, your book, Original Sin, Joe Biden's Decline, Its Cover Up, and His Disastrous Choice to Run Again. I read that book and I was slack-jawed. Now I'm interested in what you make of that story has been out. Now you are competing, if you will. You're on the book trail the same time as the former vice president is on, telling her side of that story, which it's hard to see much difference in that story and the story you told.
It's exactly right. I mean, almost everything she says in her book backs up what we reported, including Rob Reiner, the Hollywood director, yelling at her husband the night of the debate, her con you know, the concerns that she saw behind closed doors of Joe Biden, especially when he was tired, not being able to perform, her decision, her thoughts that it was reckless, her view of the top aides around Biden not conducting themselves well, not sharing accurate polling information. All of it backs up what my co-author Alex Thompson and I reported. So that's good to see.
As far as being in the newsroom at CNN, we talk about pressures that are put on shows. We see, of course, what happened with Jimmy Kimmel and Colbert, and the pressures that are put on newsrooms, including the New York Times, with a case that was filed and then ultimately dropped. Do you feel it day to day?
Yes, but the job doesn't change. The job is to be fair, accurate, listen to left wing, right wing, center, try to provide the fairest and most compelling news broadcast you can. So it doesn't change the job, but the pressure and the hate from the Trump administration, from his supporters, but also from the left, is you know, it's pretty omnipresent, but this is not a job. Journalism is not a job for people who can't take attacks and criticism. It's just part of it, unfortunately.
Best part of my day is when I turn on the lead and I see you behind the desk, number one. Number two, there's also a Phillies mug.
Yep. Big supporter of our boys, and I like their chances. I like their chances this year. I don't want to jinx anything. We Philly fans are very superstitious,
Very superstitious,
but we
yes.
seem to be peaking at a good time. And obviously, also the Eagles are 3-0, but who's counting?
That's right. Jake Tapper, it is always a pleasure to speak to you. I greatly appreciate your time. And oh, hey, are you doing a new novel?
I am starting one. Yes, I am
Okay,
starting
good.
one. Yeah.
Oh, good. I miss reading those. Those are really great.
Thank you.
The new book, Race Against Terror, Chasing an Al-Qaeda Killer at the Dawn of the Forever War. It is published by Atria. Jake Tapper, thank you so much for being with us.
It's
An
a
honor
real
to have you.
pleasure. Thank you so
Thank you.
much.
You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.